It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about teasing terrors and carnal clubs. I'm your host, Steve Taylor. And tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Shane H. Sellers and Joey Townsell are voice talents Olivia Steele, Nick Goroff, Jeff Sturdivant, Eric Peabody, and Michelle Kane. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds. And brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Shane H. Sellers and performed by Olivia Steele and Nick Goroff. In it, we meet a young woman who suffers from a fear of buttons, that experiences a horror when she opens an envelope containing four deadly buttons. Now, without further ado, I present to you Compounophobia.
Buttons are the vilest thing I've ever seen, let alone touched. Round, square, oval, and any other shape, I can't stand them. The thought of slipping my fingernail on the edge of one sends me into a panic. They adorn everything, like tiny roaches nesting, ready to infest anything. When there's one button, there are bound to be more. Do you know how hard it is to find clothing without buttons? Once I was brave enough to cut them off with scissors. However, after an episode in which I found my arm trapped within a sleeve clasped by a button, I swore off even touching the damn things. In my closet, there are exactly 3 pairs of pants, 6 gym shorts, 10 t-shirts, 3 formal long-sleeve shirts, 2 sundresses, and 2 jackets. All without buttons. People are so assuming with buttons, they put them on dolls, use them on counters, and even decorations. Ugh. Reach into your pocket and find a spare button waiting for you like a black widow inside a crawl space. Thought makes me shudder. Foul things. Who would ever think to create such a horrible accessory? Buttons are everywhere and on everything. Look at yourself. You're wearing buttons as we speak. Like fat, bloated ticks hanging on the folds of your clothes. A world without buttons would be fine with me. Burn them all, that's what I say. My therapist calls it compounophobia, but he also says I have schizophrenia and antisocial tendencies. I'm out with him at least 3 times a week, and for the most part, it helps. I don't think I'll ever be cured of the condition, and to be frank, I'm not looking to be. However, therapy has allowed me to tolerate my fear. I know what you're thinking. How could anyone have such a phobia? To me, buttons invoke a crippling fear akin to a venomous snake. Sure, not every snake is ready to strike, but would you go over and pick one up? If you were to meet me, you'd probably think I'm normal. although I can be awkward at times. I work virtually, so no going into the office for me. I don't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, but I've been told that I'm pretty. I enjoy many things you probably do, like watching Friends or having the occasional beer. However, I tend to get anxiety the longer I'm around people, which makes me a bit of a recluse. Oh, and I love comics. The pulp kind, you know, Weird Tales, Creepshow, that kind of stuff. So, I guess life is semi-normal for me. Or, at least it was. I should back up a bit. I live in a modest apartment complex on the outskirts of Charlotte, North Carolina. I've been there for at least 5 years and had no issues at all. I tend to stay inside except when I'm taking the trash out or need to run an errand. This afternoon, I'm checking the mail like I always do. Nothing much, a few bills, a credit card promotion, and a letter from a sewing outlet company. I don't think much of it as I go about sifting through the stack of letters. After separating the bills, I sit the rest of the mail down on the kitchen counter. I'm in the middle of pouring myself a glass of chocolate milk when I notice free prize inside on the outlet letter. Being a little curious, I tear the envelope open, pulling a few papers out, when four buttons the size of quarters fall onto the counter. Instantly, I jump back, flinging the chocolate milk across the room. The cup shatters, sending shards of glass skittering across the floor. I run from the kitchen to the safety of the hallway, where it takes me a good 5 minutes to catch my breath. My heart is still beating fast when I decide to peer out from the hallway to the kitchen. Four hideous red buttons sit flat on my kitchen countertop. For a few moments, I think about putting some gloves on and removing them, but these buttons are large, and I've only dealt with small ones before. I think about grabbing a broom, but then I spot it on the opposite end of the kitchen, which means I'll have to walk in front of the buttons, something that doesn't sit well with me. Then the ringer of my phone goes off, making me almost jump out of my skin. I look down to the floor to see it in a puddle of chocolate milk and broken glass. Fuck! I walk back down the hallway, cursing myself for the situation I'm in, and then I get an idea. I'll go next door and see if my neighbor John can help. I cringe at this thought, knowing I'll be replacing the buttons with a creep, but if I play it right, I can get the buttons out of my sight and then deal with him, which is better than living the rest of my life in the hallway. I won't even mention the buttons. I'll just say I dropped the milk and need some help cleaning it up. I make my way out the front door and walk to John's apartment, where I ring the doorbell. After a few seconds of waiting, the door is jerked open and an overpowering stench of weed hits me. It's John, holding a bong with bright red eyes. He leans in the doorway, surprised to see me, and I can almost see the exact second when his mind goes into full sleazebag mode.
"What's up, pretty thing? I was just thinking about you,"
he says, his body swaying back and forth. My social anxiety is starting to go into overdrive as I squeeze my hands until the nails dig into my palms. I take a few deep breaths, closing my eyes before speaking. "Could you help me with something in my apartment?" John smiles, revealing a row of bright yellow stained teeth as he reaches into his sweatpants and begins to scratch his crotch.
"Sure, baby, whatever you need."
It takes us several minutes to get back to my apartment, despite it being next door. When we finally enter my apartment, I'm not sure if John can stand straight. He walks past the hallway, ignoring the shattered glass, headed for my couch when I stopped him. I know if I let him sit, I won't be able to get him up for hours to come. Instead, I nudge him to face the kitchen counter where the buttons are. "John, can you throw those buttons and papers in the trash while I get something to clean up the milk?" I say, pointing towards the kitchen counter. John sways for a moment and then looks back at me with hungry eyes.
Sure, baby. Just give me a kiss first.
I grimace and back away, my face clearly conveying a look of repulsion that John can see.
What the fuck, bitch? You come to my house with those nice titties asking me to come to your place, and now you're changing your mind?
I put my hands up, trying to calm the situation, when he turns away from me and walks towards the counter, crushing glass beneath his feet. He stops, looks down at the buttons, before swaying his head to look back at me with another wide smile.
I get it now. This is supposed to be like one of those porn films. You know, where the plumber comes over to clean the housewife's pipes.
The words make me sick, but I can't take my eyes off the buttons just inches from his fingertips. John turns back to face the counter when one of the buttons slides towards him. My mouth drops open as I step behind the couch. I don't think he notices because he reaches down and picks the button up, placing it in the palm of his right hand. Suddenly, he jerks back, a look of pain stretching across his face as the button begins to bore down into his palm. I can see blood starting to leak from his outstretched hand as he tries to pry the button out using his fingers. Then the other three buttons seem to jump onto him like fleas to a dog. One of the buttons lands dead center on his left cheek, while the others have squirmed beneath his t-shirt. John instinctively goes to the button that is now slipping under the skin of his cheek. His head shakes violently as the button works itself up towards his nose. I continue to retreat until my back presses against the living room wall. John stumbles forward, catching himself on the refrigerator with bloody hands. His eyes search the living room until they find me, pleading for help. I'm frozen in place, struggling to breathe as the room seems to swirl around me. I can feel my feet getting heavier, my heart pounding against my chest. Then John's left eye explodes out of its socket with an audible pop. His body goes rigid as the button emerges. Then the right eye follows with another burst of gore, and he crumples to the floor. I feel weak in the knees. I want to throw up. And as I take a step forward, I black out. Later, I woke up in the darkness of my apartment. I must have been out for a few hours. My head hurts and there's a dull pain in my elbow from the fall. Using the couch, I'm able to prop myself up and investigate the kitchen. Everything is silent except for my heavy breathing as I tiptoe to the lamp in the corner. I feel around under the shade, finding the switch and turning the knob. Bright light washes across the room as I stand motionless, searching the dark recesses of the apartment. My phone is only a few feet away, the couch blocking my view of the kitchen floor. Summoning up the courage, I sneak towards my phone. My eyes fixated on the spot where I last saw John. As I move closer, I can see the broken glass and the dried milk. But John is nowhere. Perhaps he was able to find help after I passed out? Then another thought hits me hard. What if I'm hallucinating? It wouldn't be the first time I've mistakenly seen something, just not on this level. I try to push the thought out of my head, but the prospect of being committed to a mental ward still lingers. Then, there's a soft squeak down the hall, the type a sneaker makes when it scuffs a smooth surface. I look up to see John walking out of the darkness. My initial reaction is that of relief, but this is soon replaced with terror as I see light shimmering off his red button eyes. He opens his mouth as hundreds of small, gory buttons vomit forth. I fall back across the room, knocking the lamp to the floor. John smiles, his teeth now plastic buttons coated in dry blood. I scream just as the room goes dark. For the love of God, no more fucking buttons!
I hope you enjoyed Kumpanophobia, as written by Shane H. Sellers and performed by Olivia Steele and Nick Goroff. Our second tale of the evening is written by Joy Townsell and performed by Jeff Sturdivant, Eric Peabody, Olivia Steele, Nick Goroff, and Michelle Kane. In it, a hapless romantic and a recovering glutton find themselves seduced by the taste and titillation of his new friends that comprise the Test Kitchen Club. The weekly dinner parties are always a culinary delight. That is, until one takes an especially delectable turn. Now, without further ado, I present to you Test Kitchen.
Okay, so tell me the rules again. The premise sounded interesting, if not entirely original. I think I saw it on a cooking show a while back. My host smiled and patiently explained how their get-togethers were planned and executed.
It's called Test Kitchen. Every week, it's a couple's turn to host a dinner party and serve a full meal. The fun part is, the hosting couple must make something they've never attempted to make before. That's the test part. So, for example, this week is St. Patrick's Day. Lisa and I have never eaten, much less cooked, corned beef and cabbage, so we've attempted that for tonight's entree. Get it?
I nodded, but a couple of things concerned me a bit. Sounds like fun. I do feel a little like a fifth wheel, though. I don't have a significant other. You, Lisa, Mike, and Gayla make up two happy couples. I'm the odd man out.
Very odd, my man.
Jeremy, one half of tonight's hosting couple, chuckled a bit and put his arm around my shoulder.
Ken, don't worry about that. I'm sure some lucky lady will become your girl and join the fun in the near future, if that's what you want. Meantime, it's not about this being a couple's thing at all. The four of us were lucky to bump into you at the farmer's market last week and find out we all have cooking and enjoying good food in common.
Well, I've gotten pretty good at cooking a few specialties, but I'm not sure about trying new things on live television, as it were.
Hey,
Jeremy countered.
Maybe you'll surprise yourself, and us, in a good way.
I smiled, appreciating that. But something still showed on my face.
And I know you're health conscious after many years of battling a weight problem, but a little indulgence once a week might help keep you on track the rest of the time, don't you think? I know from personal experience that if you deprive yourself long enough, eventually you'll go insane and eat everything in sight. In any event, I promise we won't send any doggy bags home with you.
We both laughed hard at that. This was a man after my own heart. Yes, I see your point, I said. And I've experienced the same deprive and binge cycle myself many times.
Seriously, dude. And dinner's ready. Let's just enjoy each other's company and hope the grub turned out okay. This could be the worst meal you've ever had, or one of the best. That's the whole point.
Sounds good to me. And I have to say, the corned beef turned out better than okay. Being half Irish myself, I've been subjected to this traditional dish many times over the years, and I wasn't usually that crazy about it. But this was delicious. Especially for a first attempt. It was a little different than I expected, but very tasty. I raised my glass at the end of the meal to toast our hosts, Jeremy and Lisa. Guys, I gushed. That was fantastic. Best I've ever had. Lisa blushed a little as we drank to their culinary achievement. And, I continued, I may just have to take a doggy bag home after all.
Already got it packed for when you leave later. But for now, who's for coffee and cheesecake?
I patted my stomach, flat for the first time in years, but currently at near maximum capacity. What the hell? You only live once. Count me in. but a very small slice for me. Lisa smirked and handed me a piece larger than everyone else's. I shrugged and ate every bite. The following week, it was Mike and Gayla's turn to amaze us with their inventive cooking. They didn't disappoint, although I wasn't sure at first why tonight's entree was a test kitchen contender. Ribs? I asked. They look amazing, but... Mike grinned, a little like a mischievous boy who had just pulled one over on his little buddies.
But what's new and untried, you ask? Well, I personally have never cooked ribs this way before. But mainly, it's the sauce, my good man. Go on, try one. You've never had anything like it. Guaranteed.
Lord, more fattening food. But somehow I didn't feel as apprehensive as last week. I took a bite. People often speak of tasting something so good, it's better than an orgasm. This was one of those occasions. I found myself taking three more bites in rapid succession, the mysterious and delicious sauce covering my face in seconds.
Good?
Gayla asked. Stupid question. That's an understatement, I said in between bites. This meat is the most tender I've ever had, and this sauce, what's in it? Mike shook his index finger from side to side.
Oh, no, no, my friend. Your job is not to question why, yours is but to eat and... well, just eat.
Everyone had a good laugh. I put away what must have been an entire rack that night, and my hosts insisted I take that much home again to enjoy throughout the rest of the week. I'm embarrassed to admit I ate all of it in one sitting the very next night. And then it was my turn. The pressure was on. I wasn't a great cook to begin with. You've heard of Body by Budweiser? Well, I had that plus Body by Mickey D's, KFC, and Pizza Hut. End result? No culinary skills whatsoever. Even now, I was capable only of cooking a bland stir-fry or tasteless grilled fish, in an ongoing war with my appetite to keep the weight off. While I was racking my brain 2 days prior to our next test kitchen, I saw someone on the Food Channel make something that seemed ideal. Beer can chicken. Well, I said to myself. Self, you've never made this before, which conforms to the rules of the test kitchen credo. Plus, it looked easy. Just shove a half-full beer up a chicken's butt and put it on the grill. Simplicity itself. And that's all the self-convincing I needed. My debut test kitchen night rolled around, and I had three plump birds taking a squat over beer cans on my barbecue. To say my guests seemed underwhelmed at the evening's menu would be putting it lightly.
Well, this looks interesting.
Something I've always wanted to try, but never gotten around to making. How do you all feel about being my guinea pigs tonight?
Is it too late to barbecue guinea pigs instead?
Mike quipped. But I'm a sport, and I can take a joke. Sure is, buddy, I said. Hey, I don't know if I can come close to making something as awesome as what you've done, but... Jeremy laughed.
Hey, guys, let's give Ken a break. Test Kitchen is all about trying new things, right?
Correctamundo,
agreed Mike, turning his attention back to my birds, who had died for the cause and now had no dignity.
So, Ken, did you just put them on the grill? They look like they have a way to go.
Actually, I put them on a while ago. But the savory aroma of beer can chicken should be filling the air very soon. So the five of us relaxed, drank, and ate the pitiful snacks I offered as appetizers. After an hour, I got up to check the chickens. They were still chicken tartare, raw as hell. in that collaborative way that men have done since the prehistoric hunters squatted around a fire, roasting their prey. The three men at tonight's test kitchen examined the barbecue grill. "I don't know, guys," I said. "The fire's lit, but these things aren't cooking at all."
"Maybe because you're using indirect heat. Try using all the burners and kick it up to high."
As I did that, Mike rolled his eyes at Jeremy, and Jeremy shook his head and smiled. I'm sure I wasn't supposed to see that, but I did. That was the first time it occurred to me that Mike may have been irritated with me for something other than dinner being late. His girl, Gayla, and I flirted quite a bit. I caught her looking at me at the farmer's market, and several times since. Last week, I imagined she winked at me when Mike wasn't looking. I must have imagined it, because there was no way a former fatty like me could get the attention of a beautiful girl like Gayla. Was there? But that's just it. I was a former fatty. She didn't know me before, but I still wore clothes much too big. I still shuffled my feet and slouched. I avoided eye contact and quickly looked away when a woman caught me looking. All of these traits were clues that I used to struggle with my appearance. The birds sat on the grill for another half hour.
"Dude, check the chickens again,"
Mike said. The way he said it reminded me of Oliver Twist, asking for more. Only it was getting late, and these poor slobs hadn't had any yet. I checked. Still raw. Shit. Mike now looked really annoyed, while the other three cackled at my fuck-up. The type of overreactive laugh brought on by extreme hunger, unbalanced minds, or both. "Don't worry, gang," I said. "I guarantee you will all eat tonight."
"You go into KFC?"
Mike asked through a sneer. "No, smartass." Gayla giggled. Mike threw a look at her that I had noticed before. This I didn't imagine. It made me wonder how serious any arguments they had were, and if they ever got physical. "There's obviously something wrong with my grill," I continued. "You all just relax, and I'm going to finish these in the oven." Long story short, I'm delighted to report that I proudly served three dried out and tasteless birds about 10 o'clock that night. Needless to say, everyone was pretty anxious to leave after choking down the blocks of wood that used to resemble poultry. As they made their way to the door, Mike couldn't resist taking another shot at me.
"Great test kitchen, buddy. I'll be sure to send you the bill if we have to go to the emergency room for ptomaine poisoning."
What a jerk. After Mike was out the door, Jeremy took me aside and put his arm around my shoulder, speaking low, privately.
"Don't mind him, Ken. Truth is, he and Gayla have been having some problems lately. They're both on edge."
"Yeah," I said, looking at Gayla. "I thought I saw something. But she only seems on edge when he gets pissed." Jeremy read between the lines of that statement.
"If you must proceed, my friend, proceed with caution. But I don't blame you if you've got your eye on Gayla. She's hot as hell. But I'll deny saying that if Lisa ever asks."
I smiled and walked Jeremy to the door. "Thanks, man. Sorry the dinner didn't turn out well."
"Don't worry about it. It's your first attempt. You'll get the hang of it. That's what Test Kitchen's all about."
"So next week at your place?"
"You got it. I think Lisa and I are going to drive through Carl's Jr. on the way home tonight, though. We need a couple of famous stars to force down the dried-out chicken stuck in our throats."
I playfully slapped his arm. "Very funny, asshole. Go home and take an Alka-Seltzer." So began a routine that would continue for months. I always looked forward to our weekly test kitchens. It was always fun, even when Mike was in a bad mood. I came to value the friendship and support from Jeremy and Lisa. And I have to admit, I longed for Gala. Of course, the food was phenomenal. At least 2 weeks out of three. Two fantastic, fattening meals 2 weeks in a row. Then a crappy one every third week, courtesy of yours truly. Jeremy was wrong about that prediction. I never got better at cooking, especially experimentally. Eventually, the two couples took pity on me, even Mike, and let me off the hook. They said they would handle the cooking if I provided the alcohol. I was only too happy to oblige. Now none of us would starve every third week. But all was not hunky-dory in Test Kitchen. Mike's mood swings became more erratic, and my heart sank as I saw that Gala was losing her good humor. I could never understand why a couple would stay together if they just made each other miserable. In this case, why would Gala stay with this guy when she was deserving of someone much, much better? Someone like me. But the weekly feasts had become a huge part of my life, my only social outlet, really, and I awaited them eagerly. Unfortunately, another huge thing in my life was my expanding waistline. I knew I was going down a dark road, indulging now on a regular basis, on all the foods that were the worst for me. But it was always so fucking good. I can't explain it, really. Many of us have been there. We attempt to feed the hungry heart. We bury our insecurity, fear, and loneliness deep in the pit of our stomachs, then put junk food and sweets on top of it. But this was different. I wasn't killing myself with junk food. I was reeling in the delight of gourmet meals, provided to me every week, including leftovers that tasted even better in the following days. And I was with friends. Well, at least three of the four. To describe the feeling like the effect of a narcotic would not be an exaggeration. An inner voice, my own or possibly someone else's, urged me on. What was that old George Carlin joke? What does cocaine make you feel like? Like having more cocaine. That other voice I heard was my high school buddy's Italian grandmother, who definitely contributed to my childhood obesity. "Mangia, mangia," she said. I intended to continue doing just that. The first of two turning points came about 6 months into our Test Kitchen year. My doorbell rang, and I opened the door to find Gala standing on my porch. "Gala, what a nice surprise. It's not even Thursday. What brings you?" I swallowed the last word of my question when Gala stepped into my entryway, into the light, and I saw what Mike had done to her. "Oh my God, Gala." The sickening sight of the bruise and cut on her face made my heart sink, and my rage boiled up from my gut.
"I finally left him, Ken. I finally found the courage. I couldn't lie to myself or to you anymore."
"He's done this before?"
"Yes. Many times over the last few months in particular. Tonight he got careless, hit me in the face instead of punching and kicking me in the gut or hitting my arms and legs."
She lost it then and sobbed uncontrollably. I took her into my arms and hugged her hard. Maybe if I hugged her firmly enough, some of her pain would transfer to me. Anything to make her feel better. This woman, who I had loved secretly for months. This woman who might now appreciate a man who would treat her like the precious jewel she was. "You'll stay here tonight." Had I overstepped my bounds in saying that? Would she flee a second man that evening, realizing I was not a savior but another kook to escape? But that apprehension was unwarranted. Her reaction seemed to be one of relief and gratitude. Tomorrow, we'll get your things and bring them here. You'll stay with me until you figure out what you want to do next.
Thank you, Ken. So much. You're saving my life, you know?
You're saving your own life, Gayla. But I'm happy to help. For now, take the guest room at the end of the hall. It has its own private bath. Go get cleaned up. You'll feel better.
That's a good idea. I will.
Gayla began to walk away, then turned back and looked at me.
Ken, I love you too.
I never spoke those words out loud to her. It was as if she had read my mind. No matter. Her words were the most precious I had ever heard, or would ever hear again. That week and the week following were the only two in an entire year we didn't have Test Kitchen. Gayla moved into my guest room the day after she left Mike, but my guest room would soon become vacant again. On the eighth night, not long after Gayla and I retired to our separate bedrooms, she appeared in my doorway. The moonlight was shining through my master bedroom skylight, and I could see her beautiful body silhouette with a flimsy nightgown. Gayla, is everything okay? Are you all right?
Yes, Ken, to both questions. Things are more than okay, in fact, and I'm more than all right.
She walked into the room and slipped under the covers with me. I was immediately terrified and aroused. Are you sure you're ready for this? I asked.
Oh, I think we're both ready, and we both know it. I think we've both known it.
She reached down to my erection and began to stroke it slowly. I could only make unintelligible sounds at that moment as I looked into her eyes. I thought it was just a trick of the low light, but her eyes looked feline, and her seductive grin revealed 36 sharp teeth. For a moment, it was like I was being given a handjob by a satanic Cheshire cat. But after I blinked, it was just my beautiful Gayla, whose only motive was to please me. I attributed the hallucination to my heart wanting to pound right out of my chest, just like the lizard in Alien. For a moment, the old insecurities crept in. She sensed it immediately and took her hand off my erection to caress my cheek.
Ken, what is it? Is something wrong? Is it me?
Oh, God, no, Gayla. It's me. It's just...
What is it?
It's just that... I've gained so much weight back. And you're so beautiful. She laughed.
Baby, let me put your mind at ease. Not only do I think you're incredible, but the fact is, well, I like a man with a little meat on his bones.
Was it possible that I was fat for so long, lost the weight, then gained much of it back, just in time to find the hottest chubby chaser on the planet? Guess so.
Don't worry, lover. I'll just get on top. But first, this.
She then went under the covers and went down on me. And it was incredible. She was hungry, ravenous. And we quenched each other's appetites all night and in the weeks that followed. The following week, Test Kitchen resumed, albeit with a slightly different roster. Mike was out of the picture, and Gayla and I attended for the first time as a couple. We didn't know what to expect. I never knew how close Jeremy might have been with Mike. Would it be awkward or tense to see him and Lisa? I worried for no reason, as it turned out. They were welcoming as ever. Jeremy wasted no time in reassuring me.
Hey, buddy,
he said to me, patting my ample gut.
It's good to see you. I see Gayla has been feeding you well during our little hiatus.
And she had. Not a day went by that Gayla didn't cook something delicious and fattening in her new goal to make me the fat man of her dreams. She sure has, Jeremy. Lisa gave me a big hug, then took Gayla's hand, leading her to the kitchen. Girl talk, I suppose. I took Jeremy aside. So, you and Lisa are fine with Gayla and me?
Oh, absolutely. We couldn't be happier. Gayla made us promise not to call the cops on Mike, and I'll probably always feel guilty that we didn't. Thank God she finally left him and went to you.
Have you heard from him?
No, thank God. For all I know, and for all I care, the bastard left town. Hopefully not to victimize some other poor woman.
Jeremy's smile was thin and without humor. I had never seen such a sinister expression on his face.
You know, Ken, when we met you in the farmer's market last year, it wasn't entirely by chance.
What do you mean?
Gayla was into you right away, my man. Love at first sight. When Mike was distracted by some teenage girl in a miniskirt, she took Lisa and me aside and asked us to invite you to join our test kitchen group.
Wow. Really? I have to admit, I thought I saw something that day, but I didn't dare think it was true, you know?
Sure, I get it. I remember her gushing how cute you were. She wanted to meet you, and you just needed to put on a few pounds. I guess we've accomplished both goals.
I wasn't sure what to make of that. I wasn't very happy with myself that I was putting my weight back on, even though Gayla liked me that way. But I just smiled. A smile without humor, but not sinister and slightly evil like Jeremy's. Well, I guess it was just meant to be then, I said. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Now that's good to hear. Hey, you seem a little listless tonight. A little weak, maybe?
Yeah, maybe a little.
Well, fear not, fellow diner. Tonight's edition of Test Kitchen is a special celebration. Do we have a meal for you? Ready to dig in?
My mood lifted a bit, once again resigned to another artery-clogging, fat-saturated, scrumptious dinner. You'd have to ask me twice. My buddy's grandmother spoke in my mind. Mancha, mancha. And so a new routine commenced. No, not just a new routine. A new life. A life of love and happiness. A life of gluttony and self-destructive consumption. The sex with Gayla grew more intense and mind-blowing with each passing week. As she promised, she would climb on top of me or assume the doggy position. But more often than not, we wouldn't get past one of her incredible blowjobs. The lady had an oral fixation that wouldn't quit, and she eagerly worked on me until I came in her mouth. She swallowed every drop and smiled slyly up to me after.
What can I say? This girl likes her protein.
And with each passing week, I put on more weight, which turned her on even more. As Test Kitchen neared the completion of its first year, I realized to my horror that I had never weighed more in my life. Gayla, being the dutiful significant other, continued to buy me bigger clothes, even bigger than the ones I kept from being heavy before. I suppose I didn't have much faith in myself after all, being sure that I would stay thin and getting rid of my fat clothes. I kept them, just in case. And now, they had gotten quite tight. I had never been fatter. And she had never been more beautiful, or more aroused. One day, Gayla was out shopping for groceries, or at the big and tall store. She was always taking care of me, one way or the other. When the doorbell rang, I thought she may have forgotten to take her key. Instead, when I opened the door, I found Mike standing there. My initial shock at seeing him quickly faded when I saw he wasn't the menacing abuser I remembered. He was humble and hesitant. He seemed to be flinching from the punch to his face I would surely inflict. If he had worn a hat, he would have had it in hand.
Please, can,
he said, pleading.
Just a few minutes.
Gayla isn't here, Mike. And she doesn't want to see you anyway. Neither do I.
I know, and I don't blame either of you. And I know Gayla isn't here. I saw her leave.
So you're stalking her? Us?
No, Ken, honest. I just watched today to make sure she wasn't in the house. I don't want to scare her. Not anymore. I just wanted to talk to you. And maybe convince you to give a message to her.
The oddest thought occurred to me then. Mike didn't even seem to notice that I was almost half again as heavy than when we last saw each other. There didn't even seem to be a flicker of a reaction in his eyes. I was convinced he came here for a single purpose, and discussing my weight wasn't it. Speak your piece then, Mike, but make it quick. I don't want Gayla coming home while you're standing on our doorstep.
Absolutely. Ken, it's just this. I'm so sorry to both of you, but mainly to her, of course. I'm getting help for my problem, and I'll continue to see a good therapist when I move to another city tomorrow.
That's good news, Mike. Good news that he was leaving. Screw him and his therapy. People like him never change. It was their nature. He could no more change his spots than a leopard.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate that.
What's your message for Gayla?
Just that I'm truly sorry. And please let her know that I'm leaving town. I want her to be reassured she won't ever have to worry about seeing me ever again.
I agree. And I'll tell her. Mike extended his hand. I'm sorry, Mike, I can't shake with you. He lowered his hand and his head.
No worries. I understand.
He walked down my walkway a bit, then turned back to me. It reminded me of the first night Gayla came to me, and turned back to say that she loved me. Mike's humility evaporated for a moment, and his snide, evil grin returned.
And I have to say, Ken, you're looking really good. Being with Gayla seems to agree with you.
I had no adequate response, and he didn't wait for one. He walked to his car, started it, and was gone. But, as it turned out, I hadn't seen the last of him. Which brings us to tonight's test kitchen, being held on a special night of the week. We usually meet on Thursday, but tonight's extra special event is on Friday. Jeremy and Lisa are the hosts tonight, as we celebrate the one-year anniversary of Test Kitchen. Gayla called earlier and asked that we meet at the home of our hosts. She wants to help them prepare this very special meal. She says also that I have enriched and brought such happiness to all their lives, especially hers. Tonight's meal is dedicated to me. I am the guest of honor. I don't mind telling you, I am moved to tears. So I arrive solo. Jeremy opens the door. He's decked out in a sharp-looking tuxedo. His hair is slicked back, very stylish. He could be attending the opera at the Met. He sees my surprise, grins, and shakes my hand enthusiastically. Then, very unexpectedly, he gives me a big bear hug. He ushers me in before I have a chance to ask about his attire.
Come in, Ken, come in. Gayla will be out in a minute. She was running a bit late and decided to change from her work clothes here.
He calls toward the kitchen. Theirs is enclosed and has no view of the living room or entryway.
Han, come on out for a minute. Ken's here.
Lisa emerges from the kitchen. She's also dressed formally, in a basic black dress, accessorized by a string of pearls, and for now, a cute little apron. She has arranged her hair up in a very attractive fashion, exposing her thin, pretty neck She looks like a hot version of June Cleaver. More hotter if you think the Beeves' mom was pretty sexy to begin with.
Ken, welcome,
she says. She puts her arms around my neck and gives me a soft, sensual kiss on the lips. I have to kiss back. What choice do I have? I close my eyes only partially so I can see Jeremy peripherally. I don't want to overstep my boundaries with him, even if his girlfriend is making that very difficult. Thankfully, his broadening grin assures me that he doesn't mind his significant other's display of affection.
Excuse me, I think that's my man you're smooching.
Lisa's kiss has so aroused and distracted me, I don't even hear Gayla entering the room. Mere words cannot express how gorgeous she is. She's not wearing any jewelry, except for a pair of diamond earrings. She doesn't need anything else to look radiant. Her makeup is luscious and seductive. She's wearing a beautiful long gown and a pretty chapeau, the brim adorned with lace. Gayla smiles sweetly.
I was just getting him warmed up for you.
Lisa jokes, releasing me from her embrace. I walk over to Gayla. You are so beautiful, I say to her, lovingly and passionately.
As are you, my love.
I realize with horror that I'm wearing an old t-shirt and sweats. This, a last-minute fashion faux pas, because I couldn't button my largest pair of jeans earlier this evening. I have never been this obese, and I allowed myself to grow out of both my thin and fat wardrobes. Gayla doesn't mind. She gently places her index finger on my lips, then puts it in front of hers. Her lips and nails are a matching bright and dazzling red. I turn toward Jeremy and Lisa. I'm a little embarrassed. I'm not dressed for the occasion.
Nonsense. We're dressed formally to honor you, my friend. You're the best-looking person at Test Kitchen tonight.
Gayla and Lisa voice their agreement in unison. I notice that their words have grown as formal as their attire, which touches me even more. Gayla sees a tear on my cheek and gently wipes it away. She licks her lips, yearning for me. She kisses me with all the love in her heart.
Now, you two, you can always get a room later. First, we eat, drink, and be merry.
The decor and mood are festive, and the company is delightful as always. An entire year of food, friendship, and love. I couldn't be happier. Jeremy is conducting a special toast for the occasion. To Lisa.
Sweetheart.
To us.
Gayla and Ken, I want to express how thrilled I am to celebrate 1 year of Test Kitchen with you. It's been a big year for change, most notably for you two, Gayla and Ken. A big year for positive change. So, here's to many more.
We all join in the toast and drink the wine provided by Gayla and me. I smell something delicious cooking in the kitchen. Something new and exotic. And I expected no less on Test Kitchen night.
Ken, to further commemorate this special anniversary, the three of us got you a gift.
This is unexpected. Again, I'm touched and speechless. No matter what the gift is, the gesture, the act of love and friendship overwhelms me. But then, everything changes. Or more accurately, everything is revealed. Jeremy hands me a cardboard tube, the kind you put blueprints in. A poster or print, perhaps? He can hardly contain his enthusiasm, and the girls are beyond giddy. They sit like two teeny boppers, pressed together and holding each other's hands, ready to see this week's hunky rock star. I take the rolled up paper out of the tube and blink a few times to make sure I'm not hallucinating. My vision is a bit blurred and I'm a little wobbly on my knees, both caused by the vino, no doubt. Especially since it's becoming obvious that the wine has been spiked with something very potent. After a moment, I'm able to focus enough to begin to make out the image on the poster. What the hell? Do I speak these words aloud or just mouth them? I can't remember. Hardly matters. It's a photo of a fat, naked man on all fours. Jeremy provides the obvious answer to the obvious question.
Yes, that's you, buddy!
He shouts with maniacal glee.
Taken with a camera that Gayla hid one night when you let her turn the tables and you took it up the old poop chute. You didn't even hesitate when she brought home the strap-on.
Gayla leans in and shouts directly into my face. I feel her spittle on my face.
You're such a grotesque pervert, Ken!
But hey, it made for a great candid shot, don't you think?
What the hell is this, you freaks? I ask, terrified. Some kind of blackmail thing? So what if a guy lets his girlfriend do something kinky to him? Who cares?
Just a minute, fatso.
Gayla protests, her tone mockingly defensive and hostile.
Let's clear that up right now. I am not your girlfriend. You disgusting slob.
Whatever. I'm humiliated and terrified, cursing myself for being so easily seduced and bamboozled. My eyes are becoming an uncontrolled waterworks. Lisa puts her arm around me. Her touch is now revolting and my skin crawls, but I'm suddenly immobile, unable to shy away from her. I wanted at least a final stance of resistance indignation, but all I can do is collapse back onto the sofa.
Don't cry yet, you big baby. Keep your vision focused a minute longer. You haven't taken a good look at your gift yet.
Jeremy picks up the poster from where I had dropped it on the floor, holds it a foot or so from my face so I can take in every detail. The photo is still of me. I am still naked. I am still on all fours. But what I missed during my first horrified glance at the poster was the lines drawn, carefully and with skill, across my body. The same kind of lines that separated the primal cuts on a diagram of a cow. I look up and see the three of them licking their lips, salivating. Their expressions and facial features take on a visage of what could be described only as ghoulish. With extreme effort, I manage to get up from the sofa and try to make my way to the front door. I'm confused and disoriented. I'm mortified and terrified. None of them attempt to stop me. But I don't care. I just count my blessings. If I can just make it to the door, I can escape with my life. Simple. Delusional. They know that. Within a few seconds, I won't have the strength to make it to the door. Or call for help, even if I do.
Amazing, isn't it?
Jeremy laughs.
How can an animal be so docile until it's about to be slaughtered?
I'm just a few feet from escape when the front door flies open, slamming into my head. It's Mike. He looked great in his tux. Even better than Jeremy. Was that a rifle he was holding? Or a baseball bat, maybe?
Where you heading, big stud? You know, it's very rude to leave before the first course. Emily Post would be appalled at your breach of etiquette.
I'm barely processing the return of my rival for Gayla's affections when the electricity surges through my body. He's using a cattle prod. After several shocks, I'm out like a light. But my nightmare isn't over just yet. When I awake later, I find that I've been stripped naked, with the primal cut lines drawn on my body. For real this time. A living companion piece to the poster given to me. Maybe now hanging in the kitchen for future reference. I've also been tied securely to the bed, Plastic tarps have been spread under me and throughout the room. I don't even attempt to struggle to free myself. My fate is sealed, and I know it. It's only a matter of time, depending on whether they want to torture me a bit longer or put me out of my misery quickly and humanely. Fat chance as to the latter. As these fleeting, futile thoughts leave my head, Gayla appears for the second and final time in my doorway. She has changed out of her gown, now wears the same flimsy nightgown she wore on our first night together. Jeremy said we should get a room. Well, here we are. Gayla is again illuminated by the moonlight, a beautiful silhouette, just like the vision I saw that first magical night. Until she comes into the room. Her face is now contorted into a terrifying expression of ravenous hunger. It is the same face I saw that first night, that of a hungry cat, the one I thought I imagined. But I know this is real, and 100 times worse. Gayla's face is now that of a cannibal who has raised her livestock and has waited a very long time for her special anniversary dinner.
How you doing, baby? Comfy?
I begin to sob.
Oh, now. None of that.
She gently dries the tears from my puffy cheeks.
It will be over soon. Jeremy and Mike are sharpening the butcher knives as we speak.
She runs her fingernails lightly over my body. God help me. She still turns me on.
Oh, I see that I still have that effect on you, lover. Good.
She sits on the bed beside me and begins to slowly stroke me. I can't speak. Only moan in that pitiful way a loser does when he's with a paid escort, escaping into the fantasy until reality sets in. I moan the way a man does when he discovers the woman he loves has a hidden agenda.
I want to thank you, Ken, for a great year of Test Kitchen, especially tonight's. When we saw you at the farmer's market a year ago, I knew we could make you into the perfect entree. Just needed to fatten you up, and you made that pretty damn easy.
When I become fully erect, she stops stroking me. She kisses me softly and seductively.
And tonight's menu certainly lives up to the spirit of Test Kitchen. None of us have ever eaten human flesh before. And we have all kinds of recipes in mind for you. Because, you see, it's not always about a new dish or exotic ingredients. Sometimes, it's just about the meat.
Mike appears in the doorway then, yielding a butcher knife that looks more like a machete. He enters the room and kisses his girlfriend fully and passionately, her hand still wrapped around my cock. Mike then raises the knife, looking at me. He leers at me, his prey now caught like a rabbit in a trap.
Well, aren't you now a plump little morsel?
He takes the knife, now sharp as a razor, and runs the tip of the blade along one of the lines drawn along my thigh. He has the skill of a surgeon. The cut is so fine and precise, it takes several seconds for me to feel the sting and for the blood to well up. He dabs his index finger on my wound and tastes it.
Oh yes, baby,
Mike says to Gayla.
This is going to be delicious.
He kisses her again, and she squirms at the ecstasy of tasting my blood on his tongue.
Have your fun, babe. But hurry,
he says to Gayla.
We're getting hungry. Don't torture the poor slob too much longer. Besides, his terror might affect the taste of the meat.
Don't worry, I'm almost done with him.
Mike takes another taste of the blood, now streaming down my leg. Gayla playfully slaps his hand.
Don't ruin your dinner.
Mike smiles submissively to her, just as I've done these past months. He leaves the room, his machete stained with my blood. She turns back to me.
Here's a fun fact, Ken. They passed the Human Slaughter Act in 1958. Since then, it's been illegal to allow an animal to suffer when killing it for food. But as you can see, our little foursome isn't very humane. And we ignore the laws that suppress our chosen lifestyle.
With that, she goes down on me one last time. After a few moments of pleasure, the last I will ever have, she tears my penis from my body with her teeth. As always, she swallows. But this time she has to chew a few times first. I am finally able to find my voice and scream. And scream. And scream.
Sorry,
she says through bloodied teeth.
Couldn't resist having a little appetizer first.
She extends her index finger and thumb, holding them about a quarter inch apart.
Very little.
I hope you enjoyed Test Kitchen. As written by Joy Townsell and performed by Jeff Sturtevant, Eric Peabody, Olivia Steele, Nick Goroff, and Michelle Kane. On to the shows. Longtime resident Otis Gyrie has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out The Fear from the Heartland Archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word, and follow us on Facebook, X, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012, and consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams. Dreams.